Iran says it will not cooperate with a so-called fact-finding mission set up by the UN Human Rights Council to investigate the recent incidents in the country. Nearly 200 Palestinian and international organizations calling an international criminal court to investigate Israel's war crimes against Palestinians. Now, Russia denies reports that its forces are planning to leave the Zaporizhia nuclear plant in Ukraine. Good day, everyone. Welcome to World News. Here in the Iranian capital, I'm your host, Behrouz Najafieh. Good to have you with us. Iran has dismissed a move by the UN Human Rights Council to establish a fact-finding mission on the recent riots in the country. The Foreign Ministry spokesman says that Tehran won't cooperate with the UN mission. Nasser Kanani says Iran has already formed a national fact-finding committee to look into those events. He also warned that some Western countries are misusing the human rights issue for their own political objectives. Kanani says that such an approach undermines the legitimacy of UN mechanisms. Kanani also lashed out at Germany for co-sponsoring an anti-Iran resolution at the Geneva-based Council. He said that Germany is the same country that supplied chemical weaponry to the former Iraqi regime during the 1980s war against Iran.
As confirmed by the different exhibits and numerous reports of the German authorities and fact-finding committees of the United Nations, the companies of this country have been among main suppliers of chemical material and weapons to the aggressor regime in Iraq in its war on Iran, with the knowledge of the German government and despite warnings by the United Nations. The statistics that is available shows the Ba'athist regime in Iraq conducted 572 chemical attacks on Iran, 165 times with artillery, 79 times with shells, and 14 times with choppers. Those affected include 10,000 martyrs, some 100,000 injured, and 67,000 of them living war veterans.
Now, the Iranian Foreign Ministry also summoned the German ambassador to lodge a strong protest over Berlin's support for the anti-Iran resolution at the Geneva-based UN body. The ministry also slammed the recent comments made by German officials on the situation in Iran, calling them baseless and meddlesome. Now, we've spoken to author and commentator John Stebeling for his take on the recent anti-Iran resolution by UN Human Rights Council and Tehran's reaction.
I think there's no reason at all for Iran to participate on any level with this, because it only serves to at least partly legitimize the process, and it's an illegitimate project. Iran has nothing to gain. I think they should sever all ties with the United States, I mean diplomatic ties, because I don't see the good that can come out of it at this point. The U.S. has sanctioned Iran. These are criminal sanctions. The United States sanctions almost everybody, but they have illegally sanctioned Iran. Iran agreed to the JCPOA, bent over backwards to meet all its requirements, and the United States tore it up anyway. The U.S. is very big on tearing up treaties and international agreements. Iran has done none of that, and yet they are constantly the object of this rhetorical abuse from the U.S., Israel, Saudi Arabia, European media. It's unbelievably biased, and it's very hard, I think, for the Western public to get an accurate picture of the situation vis-a-vis Iran, because much as it is impossible for the Western public to get a picture of Russia, because the reporting is so extraordinarily biased and one-sided.
Now, on the occasion of Basij Week, Iran's leader has addressed members of the volunteer force. Basij is affiliated to IRGC, has been at the forefront of confronting rioters in Iran. In his speech, Ayatollah Khamenei said that negotiating with the United States won't resolve anything, stressing that Iran's main confrontation is against the global hegemony, not a bunch of rioters.
It was an important forum, comprised of volunteer forces that have been at the forefront in confronting the rioters. the all-too-important besieged force, which throughout the decades have not only served in the security arena, have contributed to Iran's advancements in a host of fields like science and technology. Iran's leader, in his address to them for the occasion of Besieged Week, said that these forces have sacrificed themselves in order to save people from a bunch of rioters and mercenaries. But he also advised them on who the real enemy is, that in the bigger picture, Iran's battle is not with a group of rioters, but with global hegemony. The onslaught on Iran, especially through the media, has been organized by foreign actors, like from Saudi Arabia and the UK. With US and Israel aiding and abetting their fake news, the primary goal has been to create unrest inside of Iran by inviting Iranians to come out and protest. At the same time, there are some under the misguided belief that talking to the U.S. will solve Iran's problems.
I've been notified that the U.S. president has said that he's seeking to free Iran. Mr. President, Iran was freed 43 years ago and is determined not to get subjugated. And Iran will never be your milking cow.
But Iran's leader has said that negotiating will not resolve anything, saying that our problem with America can only be resolved by letting that country hold us to ransom.
Iran has held several rounds of talks with the West over its civilian nuclear program, but negotiations have not yielded the results that Tehran wants. The main reason has been Washington's excessive demands and unwillingness to compromise. The U.S. wants to strip Iran of all its capabilities. That includes its nuclear knowledge and defense capability, like missiles.
There have been lots of speculations as to why the riots began in the first place, especially the timing, which came when the JCPOA sanctions removal talks with world powers were deadlocked over Washington's lack of commitment. It is a distinct possibility that the recent riots may have been part of the West's pressure on Iran to compromise on its rights in negotiations, including with the U.S. Yet the whole notion on continuing with these talks is not in the best interest of Iran and can never bear fruit due to the West and U.S.'s excessive demands. Realistically, the U.S. wants Iran to abandon its nuclear program, to change its constitution, restrict its influence to inside of its borders, and to close its defense industries, basically stripping the country of its identity. Some of these restrictions and excessive demands are due to Israel, which acts in line with U.S. policies to maintain dominance over the region. After all, the U.S. has worked hard to vilify Iran through Iranophobia in the region, pushing Persian Gulf Arab countries to normalize ties with Israel to unite against regional power, Iran. That is one of the reasons that Iran has time and again said that the U.S. must leave the West Asia region, as it only seeks to weaken and ultimately disintegrate Muslim countries, as stated by advisor to Iran's leader, Ali Akbar Velayati. The U.S. has played a destructive role in the region, like pushing hard for the partitioning of Iraq and Syria, trying to do the same with Iran. This has been a goal of the U.S., a West Asia region whose borders can be redrawn to their liking, with the ultimate goal of having vassal states serving U.S. interests. But when it comes to Iran, that will be an impossible feat. One only has to look at the most recent showing of Iranians when it came to their large-scale presence earlier this month during pro-government demonstrations, and for the funeral of Iranian commander Qasem Soleimani, whom the U.S. assassinated back in 2020 from a drone strike in Baghdad. Not to mention the funeral processions which Iranians participated in, the funerals held in Karaj, Isfahan, and Shiraz.
The nearly 200 Palestinian international bodies have called on the International Criminal Court to investigate Israel's acts of aggression against Palestinians. The NGOs say that a probe should cover crimes committed by Tel Aviv during its war on Gaza last August. They said that the regime is engaged in war crimes and crimes against humanity, including crime of apartheid against Palestinians. They're calling for appropriate measures to prevent such crimes. The organization has also slammed Israel's move to label Palestinian civil society organizations as terrorists. They called for public condemnation of such measures. Palestinians have witnessed a sharp increase in Israeli attacks. The regime has killed more than 200 Palestinians this year, almost a quarter of them children. An international conference has been held in the Gaza Strip to highlight the Israeli blockade and its dire consequences on the Palestinians. The Israeli regime has kept the Gaza Strip under a tight blockade since 2007. Our correspondent Ashraf Shannon has more in his report.
Hamas's Council on International Relations has held an international conference on the impact of the Israeli blockade. The event aims to shed light on the crippling Israeli blockade on more than 2 million Palestinians living in the Gaza Strip. The event was attended by figures representing the Gaza Government Committee and civil society organizations. They discussed ways to tackle the repercussions of the blockade. Living conditions and the standard of living in the Gaza Strip have been rapidly deteriorating under the Israeli blockade. The Hamas movement says Western countries, mainly the United States, are supporting the Israeli blockade. Speakers via video conference included Francesca Albanese, the special rapporteur on the situation of human rights in Palestine, as well as Richard Falk, the chairman of the Euro-Mediterranean Human Rights Monitor. Statistics show that most Gazans are impoverished and rely on handouts to survive because of the blockade. Unemployment and poverty rates have skyrocketed under the blockade. At the conference, attendees called for the immediate lifting of the inhumane siege.
This is a call to the war to stop its a silence over what's been going on the Gaza Strip, and to urge all governments of the world in Europe and the United States and other parties around the world to intervene actively to end this illegal and punishing siege on the Gaza Strip population.
In its final communique, the conference announced that the Gaza Strip is already devastated by the Israeli blockade and is edging closer to breaking point. The prolonged blockade has undermined all aspects of life in the Gaza Strip since 2007. Experts say the inhumane Israeli practices have deprived Palestinians of their rights. Ashraf Shana, Gaza.
Russia rejecting allegations that its forces are planning to leave the Zaporizhia nuclear plant in southern Ukraine. A senior Ukrainian official has said that there were signs that Russian forces were preparing to leave the complex. The Kremlin has denied any such move. It says that the plant will remain under Russia's control. Russia seized the plant just weeks after it launched a military offensive in Ukraine. The area has come under repeated shelling, with each side blaming the other. Last week, Moscow accused Ukrainian forces of continued shelling of the plant, warning it could lead to a nuclear disaster. A series of strikes has caused widespread damage to Europe's biggest nuclear power plant. Meantime, the UN Nuclear Agency has called for the creation of a safe zone around the complex. Morocco's FIFA World Cup win against Belgium has triggered clashes, and that after a Moroccan community burst into celebrations in the Belgian capital, Brussels. Dozens of fans smashed store windows, threw fireworks, and set fire vehicles. Around 100 officers used tear gas and water cannon to disperse the rioters. 11 people were reportedly arrested. Also in the eastern city of Liège, a gang of 50 people attacked a police station, breaking windows and damaging two of their cars. Police there also resorted to water cannon. Belgium is home to around 500,000 people of Moroccan descent. Morocco beat Belgium 2-0 in the World Cup face-off. In Austria, railway workers have staged a day-long strike over pay, bringing trains to a standstill and creating travel chaos across the country. The strike has impacted some 8,000 connections and some 1 million passengers. A 24-hour walkout followed the failure of a fifth round of negotiations between the government and the union. The main rail workers' union is calling for a $417 monthly pay rise for 50,000 employees. The union has warned about more industrial actions. Authorities say the services would be more or less back to normal by the following day. Austria is an important hub for rail travel in Europe, connecting 8 countries, including Italy, Germany, Switzerland, Hungary, and the Czech Republic. The death toll from a landslide in Italy's southern island of Ischia has risen to 8, as rescuers are searching for 4 people who remain missing. A newborn baby and 2 kids were among the 8 people killed. The government has declared a state of emergency. Dozens of workers have rushed the flood-hit island. A wave of debris and stones broke away from the island's highest mountain and swept through a small town early Saturday. Aerial footage shows the destruction of buildings and cars pushed into the sea. Ischia is a densely populated volcanic island which lies some 30 kilometers from Naples. November 28th marks the third anniversary of a U.S. deadly drone strike on a civilian car in Afghanistan. It killed all five people in the car, including three women. A correspondent has a report.
Back on November 28, 2019, an American drone strike hit a car returning from a maternity hospital in southeastern Afghanistan. The attack left five people dead, including a woman who had just given birth, three of her relatives, and the driver. The Afghan people, especially the relatives of victims, remembered the U.S. drone strikes as terrifying and unforgivable.
The targeted people were members of my uncle's family. They were martyred cruelly and horrifically. After giving birth to her son, my aunt's situation worsened. Then they left for the hospital together with my cousins. When returning from the hospital, their car was bombed by a U.S. drone strike. In total, three women, a boy called Nora John, and the driver, Mohammed Nabi, were martyred.
Human rights advocates stress that such attacks show the reality of the U.S. war on Afghanistan. They criticize the failure of the U.S. to account for civilian victims of its airstrikes. According to verified reports, throughout the two-decade U.S. occupation of Afghanistan, over 13,000 airstrikes were conducted by American forces in the country. The U.S. drone war on Afghanistan killed up to 10,000 people, including many women and children. Afghan people are still suffering from the wounds inflicted by the U.S. occupation of their country. They call for justice for American forces' atrocities on their soil. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
That's a wrap for this news bulletin. Goodbye.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.
The ocean of dua.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين ثم الصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين Hello everyone, brothers and sisters. I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi with you with another edition of the program, The Ocean of Dua. In this edition of the program, we'll have a glance at Kumail's supplication and we'll discuss a commentary on that. We'll be back in a few seconds, so stay tuned. Allahumma azma bala'i wa afrat bi su'hali wa qasrat bi a'mali wa qa'adat bi aghlali wa habasani 'an naf'i bu'd amali وخدعتني الدنيا بغرورنا ونفسي بجنايتنا Dear listeners, previously we were discussing this excerpt of the Divine Kumail supplication. أم كيف يتغلغل بين أطباقها وأنت تعلم صدقه? How should he be convulsed among its levels while you know his sincerity? أَمْ كَيْفَ تَزْجُرُهُ زَبَانِيَتُهَا وَهُوَ يُنَادِيكَ يَا رَبَّ How should its keepers torture him while he calls out and says, O Lord? أَمْ كَيْفَ يَرْجُو فَضْلَكَ فِي عِتْقِهِ مِنْهَا فَتَتْرُكُهُ فِيهَا How should he have hope of your bounty and mercy in freeing him from it while you abandon him within it? هَيْهَات Far be it from you. مَا هَكَذَا ظَنُّ بِكَ Such is not expected of you. As you may have been with us, previously we concluded that there are different needs, based on the perception and presentation before the Lord of the Universe, which accompany together all these three constituents, make up for the spirit of supplication and dua. We concluded, and as we said earlier, these kinds of needs that are accompanied with supplication, that are perceived by the servant and presented before the Lord of the universe, are more intense in attracting the mercy of Almighty Allah. Now, the question is, why the descent of Allah's mercy is more intense if the need is accompanied with dua? Why is the relation between prayer and the response much stronger than the first case? That is, in relation between the need which is devoid of prayer and mercy of Allah. Now, by answering this question, we will have a better understanding of the relation between prayer and its acceptance and the secret behind it. Now, to try to answer this question, we try to refer to different laws regarding this aspect of the mercy of the Lord. There are different laws governing in the universe. There are different sunan. One law is that the relation which exists between that faqr and the mercy of Allah, as we have explained in the previous episodes, is that this ontological need is one reason of attraction of Allah's mercy. Each state from among the different states of prayer and dua entails a state of indigence and neediness toward Allah's mercy. This is the first station among the various stations of Allah's mercy. The second law is denoted by the relation between the need after its realization and the mercy of Allah. Of course, the realized need differs from the need before its perception. Both of them are need and indigence, of course. Both of them attract Allah's mercy and invoke it. But one of them is the kind of the non-realized need, and the other is the kind of realized need. This is what we have explained earlier on. The non-realized need is that state in which a man is in need of Allah without him being aware of his neediness toward him. And at times, he might not even know who Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala is. But the realized need has that awareness in it. That is why it is more seen and it is attracting Allah's mercy more.
Oh Allah, my trials and sufferings have increased and my evilness has worsened. My good deeds have diminished and my misdeeds have become firm. And remote hopes restrain me from profiting with good deeds. And the world has deceived me with its allurements, and my own self has been affected by treachery and my delay. Therefore, my Lord, I ask you by your greatness not to let my sins and my misdeeds veil my supplications from you, and not to disgrace me by exposing those of which you have knowledge, nor to hasten my retribution for those vices and misdeeds committed by me in secret, which were due to evil-mindedness, ignorance, excessive lustfulness, and my negligence.
Thank you, Allah, that we here feeling so good about all the things that we went through, knowing that God is pleased with us too. It's not a dream, this is so true, and we know we'll be here forever. The feeling is indescribable, knowing that this is our reward.
The ocean of dua.
Now, who is the realized one? Who is the one who is aware of his ontological indigence to Allah? Why does this state attract mercy of Almighty Allah more? The servant, when he or she is aware of the need, this state solidifies the state of neediness, such that the greater and more firm the neediness, the greater the capacity of the soul for receiving the mercy of Allah. You may have been previously with us, and we mentioned earlier that there is nothing like inability and miserliness with regard to the treasures of the Lord. But it is the capacity of the people in receiving the mercy of Allah that differs. The greater the capacity of a person, the greater would be his share from the mercy of Allah. The capacity here implies that ontological poverty, which somehow gets intensified by man's degree of awareness about his own neediness toward Allah. And this is what increases that capacity. Let us provide an example about this. A guilty person who is aware that he is being taken for execution is able to attract the sympathy of the people and the rulers much more than a one who is being taken for execution without being aware of that. Both of them, of course, are being taken for the same kind of execution. And the one who has confessed his guilt and knows the punishment that awaits him attracts the affection of the people more than the others. And he is aware of his crime and punishment, while the other is not. I assume with this example, we can understand and have a better perception of the realized need and the unrealized one. Thank you for staying with us, dear listeners. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also, visit our website at parstoday.com. Until the next program, take care and goodbye.
Economic divide.
The ASEAN summit has taken place, and the U.S. presented a strategic partnership agreement to those countries. Now, will it be enough to sway those countries into its sphere, or is it going to face a resounding defeat when it comes to Chinese influence in trade? Hi, I'm Kabat Ahwe. Welcome to Economic Divide. Coming up in today's program, some of the highlights. When it comes to U.S.-ASEAN relations, we will take a look at that. Years of diplomatic freeze, this came from the U.S. side. Well, the former U.S. President Donald Trump's lackluster approach was one of the reasons, many dubious of U.S.'s long-term commitments to that region. So we have to wait and see, later on in the program, how that pans out. Then we have the U.S. initiative, in which it was called by the current U.S. President Joe Biden, the Strategic Partnership. Well, it's called for a free and open Indo-Pacific to counter China. But will it work with that aim in mind? And finally, the U.S. goal is confronting China. We ask ASEAN countries whether that's going to work, or are they going to stiff arm China and live with potential consequences? The stiff competition, RCEP.
The U.S. and Chinese presidents have ended a landmark meeting in Indonesia's Bali. During the meeting, Joe Biden and Xi Jinping reiterated the necessity of handling their relations in a peaceful and proper manner. Biden said the U.S. wants to manage differences with China to prevent competition from becoming a conflict. For his part, Xi said that he is looking forward to working with Biden to bring Beijing-Washington ties back on the right track. Before the meeting, Biden traveled to Cambodia to underscore the U.S. partnership with the Association of Southeast Asian Nations, or ASEAN, countries. One of Biden's primary aims during that trip was to counter China's growing influence in that region. Biden announced the U.S.-ASEAN Comprehensive Strategic Partnership and noted a budget request for $850 million in assistance for Southeast Asia. Biden also pointed to a new U.S.-ASEAN Electric Vehicle Infrastructure Initiative, which is aimed at strengthening the U.S. foothold in that region for further economic integration.
Through our new U.S.-ASEAN Electric Vehicle Infrastructure Initiative, we're going to work together to develop an integrated electric vehicle ecosystem in Southeast Asia, enabling the region to pursue clean energy, economic development, and ambitious emissions reductions targets.
It is no secret that China and the U.S., as two superpowers, are vying for influence in the region. The two countries are locked in a number of disputes, which includes trade, Taiwan, hegemony over the South China Sea.
Online content on this, as posted by viewers, is varied, but it wants to find out whether there's a U.S. commitment. That's what we found out when it came to the social media post. This is our first post, for example, where it said, ASEAN is at the heart of my administration's Indo-Pacific strategy. Thank you for 45 years of partnership and for all that we can accomplish together. Next one, the U.S. on Saturday upgraded its ties with the Association of Southeast Asian Nations, vowing to deliver more aid as President Joe Biden steps up efforts to counter China's growing influence in the regional bloc. Now, we dug a little bit further and looked at this. U.S. doubles down on ASEAN aid to counter China, making his first trip to Southeast Asia as president. Biden said that the two sides will tackle the biggest issues of our time, from global warming to significant threats to the rule-based order, along with threats to the rule of law. Next, this tweet seeking to counter China. Biden and hosts ASEAN leaders had a post within a post in which we found interesting, and it was titled, Seeking to Counter China, Biden Hosts ASEAN Leaders. Now, this happened back in May 2022. Looking deeper into the post, it said, with the administration of former U.S. President Donald Trump pulling the U.S. out of the Trans-Pacific Partnership, or the TPP, and the U.S. not part of the RCEP, the Regional Comprehensive Economic Partnership Agreement, of which China is a part of, Washington ceded ground to Beijing in the ASEAN region, especially as far as economics is concerned. Okay, so those were some of the posts there. Let me introduce our guest for this edition of the program. Joining us for the first segment of the Q&A is Kim Do-ju. He's a political commentator at the Pangol Institution. Kim Do-ju, welcome to Economic Divide. We are looking at President Joe Biden, where he's come out saying that the relationship between the U.S. and ASEAN countries is at the heart of the U.S. administration's Indo-Pacific strategy. Of course, this comes really after a diplomatic freeze, especially from the U.S., former U.S. President Donald Trump, which didn't have a real warm approach to the region as a whole. Biden now has to step up ties. Do you think that he's going to be able to do that, especially with the intention of trying to counter China's growing influence? Will he be successful?
If the goal is to counter China, I'm sure it is doomed. He will not succeed in that direction. The reason is simple. If you look at the relationship between ASEAN countries and China, for example, and this year, despite this pandemic linking over the two sides and other kinds of challenges, if you look at the trade relationship between the two sides, it still scored double-digit growth in the last 10 months of this year. And it's expected to, the total volume of the two sides could reach as high as $1 trillion this year or early next year. this is a strong signal showing to the world that how close China and ASEAN are. Look, the U.S. has a presence mostly, and unfortunately, is a military presence, you know, military bases in Japan, South Korea, in the Philippines, or Thailand. You know, for the U.S., the purpose is to maintain its dominance in this region as well as around the world. For China, it's really about the co-development, a win-win cooperation.
Okay, that's thoughts of Kendra Du there. Richard Black joins us now. He's from the Schiller Institute, and he's a UN representative. Richard Black, welcome to our program. In terms of countering China, U.S. President Joe Biden has said that he wants to build what he has termed as the U.S.-ASEAN Comprehensive Strategic Partnership, in which he said it's going to be an Indo-Pacific region that's free and open, stable and prosperous, resilient and secure. But China and the regional countries are part of the RCEP. That's a huge trade bloc composed of 15 countries. How could the U.S. compete with that? And what should the regional countries be interested in when it comes to U.S. initiatives?
Well, this is a very good question. Look, China has just built, in conjunction with the government of Laos, Laos's first super high-speed railroad. This is part of a plan for all of Southeast Asia called the Pan-Asian Railroad Network. At the G20 summit in Indonesia, prepared a Chinese-designed high-speed rail line connecting the great cities of Bandung and Jakarta. It's now 90% complete. So if the U.S. wanted to succeed in competing, then it would follow China's policy and do likewise. Or to put it another way, how many kilometers of high-speed rail are there in Laos, and how many in the United States? Well, in Laos, because of China's policy, there are 1,400 kilometers of high-speed rail. How many kilometers in the USA? Zero. So the United States could compete, but they would have to emulate China's policy of build, 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 and transfer advanced technology to the former colonial, the underdeveloped, the looted sector.
It's time now from the Info News section of the program, where we take a look at news from around the world. Well, our first item talks about something that's very important, deemed important by Economic Divide, and that's a multipolar world. Now, there's an effort being put forward on that front where China is saying that it wants to help build a multipolar world. Wang Yi told his Russian colleague or counterpart Sergei Lavrov that Beijing will work with Moscow in order to achieve that. Now, China is ready to work with Russia and also other like-minded countries in order to promote the development of a multipolar world, firmly to support the process of democracy and when it comes to international relations, and to defend the international system that's based on the UN. So that is something, obviously, that's very important when it comes to the, some call it the New World Order, but revised. Next up, another huge layoff from a big conglomerate by the name of Amazon, which I'm sure you heard of. Massive layoffs have been actually executed, where it's going to sack thousands of workers. The layoffs reportedly coming, perhaps by the time you watch this program, they're going to be happening. U.S. Giant Amazon may fire up to 10,000 employees. That's the projected number. Now, the news of potential job cuts comes days after Facebook parent Meta and also Twitter each carried out massive layoffs, sending clear signals that the tech sector is preparing for an inevitable recession. Next up, the status of the U.S. credit is under question here when it comes to consumers. You have some retail store credit cards that at this point are now carrying APRs of more than 30%. Now, the rate hikes comes by the Federal Reserve, in which major retail credit cards, you may have heard of some like Bloomingdale's, Macy's, Shell, or ExxonMobil and Wayfair, where they recently bumped up their maximum APRs to more than 30%. Now, what does that mean? Well, this means that high inflation is forcing American consumers to rack up more debt, and that's not good news because obviously they have to pay that amount, the principal amount, plus the interest that is accrued on that. Next up, we go to Australia. The topic we've chose was slavery, in which there was a law that is not working. A coalition of rights groups have called on the government to strengthen anti-slavery legislation. Australia's businesses are failing to address forced labor risk. Well, that's an important topic when it comes to their supply chains. Now, this comes 4 years after the introduction of slavery laws, in which 2 out of 3 companies is not following that. Those were the topics we picked for our InfoNews section. Please do send us any ideas from your part of the world. We would really appreciate it. Contact information is on your screens.
Economic Divide. The series looks at the financial health of the economies around the world and its impact on countries. You can listen to Economic Divide on Mondays and Tuesdays on IRIB English Radio.
The in-depth section is upon us. To get an understanding of this rivalry between China and the U.S., which the IMF has said risks splintering the global economy, we need to take a look at the trade activity between China, the U.S., and ASEAN countries. Now, back in the year 2020, U.S. goods and service trade with ASEAN totaled $362.2 billion. Exports came in at $111.9 billion, imports $250.3 billion, and the U.S. goods and services trade deficit with ASEAN was $138.4 billion. Now, moving on to the year 2021, the trade volume of the goods between China and ASEAN in this case was $878.2 billion. It reached a year-on-year increase of 28.1%. Among them, China's exports came in at $483.69 billion. That's 26.1% increase year-on-year. And then imports were $394.51 billion, an increase of 30.8%. ASEAN actually became China's largest trading partner, which was for the second consecutive year. Vietnam, Malaysia, and Thailand are China's top three trading partners in ASEAN. Now, by comparison, total trade for the U.S. and ASEAN countries was, well, $362.2 billion, in which China's trade with ASEAN countries was $878.2 billion. Now, if you take a look at this chart here, not chart really, but you can see the difference there, how much more it is. It's almost three times that amount. Now, while the U.S. is trying to build a U.S.-ASEAN strategic partnership, which it describes as a free and open Indo-Pacific, in order to counter China, it's going to have a hard time doing that because of the RCEP, the Regional Comprehensive Economic Partnership, which includes 15 East Asian and Pacific nations. It encompasses 30% of the world's GDP. In terms of the trade, comes in at $2.3 trillion among its members. 90% of tariffs on goods, that's eliminated within the bloc. So how can the U.S. even begin to compete with that, let alone try to woo the ASEAN members into joining its partnership agreement? I mean, the figures speak for themselves. Okay, let's have our guests rejoin us and get a breakdown on this. We have Kin Do Ju, political commentator at the Pangol Institution, who rejoins us. Kin Do Ju, welcome back to Economic Divide, U.S. goals in the South China Sea to confront China or to slow down China as they'd like to, which has not ruled out military confrontation, as I'm sure you're well aware of, things like Taiwan, for example. How can regional countries even entertain the thought of war when it comes to this rivalry between the U.S. and China, especially in their own backyard?
Well, obviously, regional countries are perfectly clear of the U.S. strategy to contain China or to have a new Cold War, and they are not warming up to such an idea because they are not for a divided world or divided region. They are for more integration and more investment and trade, more integration in this region, because that's their priorities.
Richard Black comes in now in order to have his take on this. He's from the Schiller Institute and a UN representative. Richard Black, welcome back. U.S. goals when it comes to China, it is obvious that they not only see China as a rival, they want to contain China, and they want China to be slowed down when it comes to obviously things like its economic prowess. At the same time, we're looking at a U.S. that has somewhat of a militaristic tone when it comes to China. Are they going to be able to do that? And then comes the countries. Will the U.S. be able to rally those countries behind it?
Well, again, let's refer to the excellent leaders of the ASEAN. The very courageous leader of Cambodia, Hun Sen, made a very strong statement at the ASEAN this week again, and I'll quote, let's look at what the leaders of Asia themselves are saying. He said, a spirit of togetherness in upholding open and inclusive multilateralism, pragmatism, and mutual respect in addressing the existential and strategic challenges we all face. That's the key, inclusive multilateralism. So what's going on? Let's set this in context. There's a new international monetary and trade system being currently formed based on the idea of transferring advanced energy-intense technology to the global south, the former colonial sector. Russia and China are playing the leading role in this. It involves the SCO, ASEAN, the BRICS. So what we're calling for is a very loud chorus internationally of the non-aligned sector, as it has always been called, a renewed vigor coming from the renowned the non-aligned sector, calling for an end for this global NATO drive for nuclear war. And of course, we feel that Iran could play a very leading role in such an international course. The big issue is whether or not there's going to be a nuclear war triggered by global NATO.
The South China Sea is a major trade route. China is a dominant power there. An estimated $3.4 trillion worth of international shipping trade passes through that area each year. China has gained effective control of the route, which has economic, strategic, and political importance. China and the regional countries are also part of the RCEP, which stands for the Regional Comprehensive Economic Partnership. The RCEP is a free trade agreement among the Asia-Pacific nations. The 15 member countries account for about 30% of the world's population and 30% of global GDP. China is a major player in that economic pact.
The world now is facing unprecedented situation. It's important that in the recovery of together, we are focusing on the collaboration aspect. The theme on the B20 is advancing innovation, inclusion, and collaboration. So I think this is really three areas that's very important where the China can play a role.
U.S. goals in the South China Sea is to ultimately confront, then slow down China, which it has not ruled out military confrontations on issues like Taiwan. China also enjoys the status of a comprehensive strategic partner with ASEAN, or the Association of Southeast Asian Nations. In 2021, the trade balance between ASEAN members and China came to $668.9 billion, compared to U.S.'s $364.4 billion. Beijing investments in that region were $13.5 billion, while the U.S. invested $40 billion there.
When it comes to the ASEAN countries, the US and China are vying for influence. The question is, who is in the lead? We argue that there isn't even a competition, since China has beaten US by far. First, the trade volume between China and the Association of Southeast Asian Nations has skyrocketed 85 times over the past three decades. Over the past 30 years, the business communities of China and ASEAN have jointly promoted the China-ASEAN Free Trade Area, participated in the Belt and Road Initiative, and supported the Regional Comprehensive Economic Partnership negotiations, making important contributions to the continuous development of China-ASEAN economic and trade cooperation. Asian countries have also been working toward financial integration for many years, and a new joint statement made by China, Japan and South Korea, and ASEAN countries deepened the trend. The Chiang Mai Initiative, multilateralization, one of the arrangements that fosters financial integration among Asian countries. It is a multilateral currency swap arrangement between ASEAN plus three members. This addresses short-term liquidity difficulties in the region. It also aims to create a regional foreign exchange reserve in a bid to tackle the imbalance in international payments and short-term liquidity shortage. Participants agreed on a $240 billion fund, among which ASEAN countries will contribute 20%, while Japan and China will each put in 32% and South Korea will contribute the rest. When it comes to the ties between ASEAN countries and Chinese President Xi Jinping, the Chinese president in November 2021 called for a new round of what he called upgrades in the free trade area between China and the ASEAN. And what about the U.S.? History has tainted its relationship with ASEAN and the region as a whole. Let's dial back to the previous U.S. administration led by former U.S. President Donald Trump. During the 35th summit in 2019, it was reported that the United States lost ground in its struggle with China for the hearts and minds of Southeast Asia. It contributed this to the decline in U.S. soft power in the region, which had accelerated. It also laid blame on U.S. withdrawal from Trans-Pacific Partnership, along with former U.S. President Donald Trump's America First policy. The America First policy, which neglects the region's strategic interests while economically punishing and alienating potential supporters, is something the current president, Joe Biden, is striving to correct. So, you see, the U.S. has a lot of catching up to do, and given its confrontational approach to China, which is militaristic in nature, it doesn't look that it will stand a chance to pull countries in this region into its sphere. That does it for this edition of the program.
Don't doubt it, the U.S. is going to push its agenda in the South Asian region, with the number one goal being countering China. This will be void of what the U.S. has called a healthy competition that the U.S. says it is open to. The reason is that the U.S. cannot see itself cede its number one status in the world as a superpower. Will the U.S. prevail, or will China? Well, if you ask ASEAN countries, or Latin American countries, or countries in West Asia, or countries in Africa, they're going to say China. Then what's left? That does it for this edition of the program. It was great having you with us. From Ikobe Tagwe, it's goodbye until the next Economic Divide.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz for Europe, and 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz for Southern Africa. And FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.